This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. On this podcast, a look at the latest employment law news out of California and how it's affecting employers. It's no secret that California has been a groundbreaking state when it comes to employment law. The past several months did nothing to diminish that reputation as a number of new laws took effect in late 2012. Now that we're a few months into 2013, it seems like the perfect time to take a look at the latest goings-on in the Golden State and how they're affecting HR. Plus, the California Supreme Court has made news as well. So to get to the bottom of all of these developments and more, we're very pleased to have Chris Kobe with us. Chris practices in San Jose with Littler Mendelsohn, the nation's largest law firm exclusively representing employers. He's handled a broad range of legal matters affecting the workplace and is a frequent speaker on employment law topics. Chris, thanks for joining us.
David, glad to be with you.
Well, Chris, as I alluded to, California passed a host of new employment laws recently that took effect around the first of the year. Are there one or two in particular that really stand out to you as especially significant for HR?
David, you're asking a lawyer to limit himself to one or two, but I'll do my best. The ones that I think are most important that HR personnel need to be aware of and comply with in 2013 are those involving personnel files, because the California statutes were expanded to increase the penalties and set deadlines for employers to respond to requests for certain portions of employee personnel files. And those are set forth in 1094.5 of the Labor Code. And if employers don't follow these rules and follow the requirements of the statute, they can be subject to penalties of hundreds of dollars. So it's something to be aware of. Another area in which California employers have got to toe the line are written commission agreements. Those were actually enacted. The statute was enacted 2 years ago, but it takes effect the first of this year. So if HR people have any employees who are affected or paid by on a commission basis, they need to have a clear written agreement on the basis of how they are paid. And the complication this sometimes creates for us is that a lot of people will mistake bonuses for commissions, and the definition of commission in California is pretty straightforward. It is a commission arising from the sale of a product, and it is not making a product or rendering a service. So if your employees are covered by commission payments of that kind, they need to have a written agreement.
Have you received a lot of questions from clients about this compensation agreement with the commission arrangement?
Yes, especially the commission agreement. There have been some questions on the personnel file legislation, but the commission agreement seems to generate a lot of questions as to whether what they are paying does constitute a commission for the purpose of the statute and that they have to provide it in writing. But California in the last 2 years has gone much more towards providing information in writing at the outset to its employees as to how they're paid, and this is part of that. The other new enactment that may affect anybody who's got employees who work in San Jose or have a facility in San Jose is San Jose is the fifth city in the country to enact its own minimum wage, and it's by far the largest city to do so. And that new requirement of a minimum wage of $10 an hour takes effect a week from today.
On another note, California's Fair Employment Housing Act also expanded the definition of sex to include breastfeeding recently. What should employers know about that?
Well, the legislature, when it enacted that law, David, said that it was declaratory of existing law, which is the legislature's way of saying there's nothing new here. But, of course, they did pass the new law, so it must mean something. What it was intended to do, I think, was to emphasize to employers a woman's right to engage in breastfeeding and to express breast milk at the workplace when that can be done, and that the denial of the right to do that can result in sanctions, which are listed under the California Fair Employment and Housing Act. Of course, the Fair Employment and Housing Act has expanded since it was first passed way back in 1959. Currently, it has 18 protected categories. And, as a matter of fact, the legislature is considering adding a new category, at least one, and clarifying others in legislation that's pending right now in Sacramento.
Now, these laws have been out there for more than 2 months now. Can you tell us the nature of some other questions that you may have been hearing from clients? I know we talked a little bit about the one with commission arrangements, but what else have you been hearing?
Well, we're getting questions about the new requirements for wage statements. Again, much of this would be seen by people who are not lawyers as really tinkering around the edges. But there's a reason for the tinkering, and there are reasons for the policy changes that are sought and that are implemented. For example, if California employers do not have the necessary information, and there are 9 categories of information they have to have in their wage statements, which are also known as pay stubs, they can be subjected to a host of penalties. But more importantly, employees can sue and bring class actions for violations of wage and hour laws, including pay stubs, and we're seeing a lot of that. So these are highly technical laws, and for those employers who have outside payroll services, of course, those services are expected to comply with the law, but if employers are doing this themselves, they want to be absolutely certain that they're in compliance, because the penalties can be really nasty.
As noted at the top of the podcast, Chris, California's always been a bellwether state, to say the least, when it comes to employment law. What do you see on the horizon legislatively as we move forward in this year?
Well, 10 days ago, the deadline passed for each house of the state legislature to introduce its bills to be considered in the 2013 legislative session. And they are about at least 77 bills involving labor and employment law. To me, the ones that are interesting are more restrictions and deadlines and requirements on payroll records. There's a bill in the being considered in the state Senate to increase the or expand the definition of sexual harassment to include threats of sexual violence, and to specify that an act is sexual harassment regardless of the sexual orientation, sexual desire, or intent of the harasser. That's a common thing that comes up in sexual harassment cases. You know, can a woman sexually harass a woman, or a man? And the answer, at least most people in California know by now, is yes. And so that would be an expansion. The aspect of the possible expansion of the Fair Employment and Housing Act would be to add the protected characteristic of homelessness to the list of protected categories, and that's being considered in the state assembly, so we'll see what happens there. Most of the bills that have been introduced so far usually expand the penalties or increase the penalties for violations of the law. The major one probably will be, just like in Washington, D.C., a proposal to increase the state minimum wage, and that will probably have a lot of political appeal, and I wouldn't rule out that bill being passed.
You know, that's quite interesting what you said about the law about protecting the homeless, because we just did a story a few months back about Rhode Island becoming the first state in the nation to pass the law banning discrimination against homeless individuals. And sounds like from what you're saying, California may well become the second state to have a law like that.
Sure. When you've got 50 or 51 jurisdictions out there and one of them gets an idea and passes it, a lot of others will say, hey, that sounds good to us too. And a good example of that is the social media law, which actually started in the state of Maryland. And I think at last count there have been about 9 or 10 other states that have either enacted or are considering restrictions on the use of social media by employers. So this is what's called the laboratory of democracy, the state legislatures throughout the country considering various policy choices and choosing which ones they're going to follow.
Again, we're speaking with employment attorney Chris Kobe of Littler Mendelson in San Jose. Chris, what is it that you think makes the Golden State just so unique in this area of employment law?
Well, I think a couple of things, David. First is just sheer size. When California makes up 10% of the nation's population, you're going to have a lot more proposals bubbling up and fermenting from various interested groups in the state of California. And as most of your listeners probably know, California is right now quite definitely a blue state. There are no Republican statewide office holders, and both houses of the state legislature are held by Democrats by two-thirds majorities. So it's a very Democratic state, and the various interest groups can be very strong. But I think it's really due to the size and also the diversity of the population. You have a lot of interest groups interested in a lot of different kinds of policy changes. And I think California, its history has, going back 100 years when it felt that it was controlled by the Southern Pacific Railroad, created the initiative and the referendum for the state's voters. And those have morphed and changed over a period of time, and many policy decisions, of course, are made by initiatives.
Now, going back to something you just touched on a couple of minutes ago, that social media password protection law, perhaps contrary to California's pro-employee reputation, that law actually has a provision that might give HR at least some comfort. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the California law does specifically state, as some of the other states' laws do not, that there is a right to access social media under certain circumstances if management believes that the employee is stealing trade secrets or sending sensitive data or something like that. I think what that reflects is California's ability to more carefully consider the exact limitation on social media for employers and to carve out sections which do make sense for employers, especially in California and the Silicon Valley, of people stealing data electronically and people doing something as simple and unwise as adding data to emails and sending them to their home address, which is something we see fairly frequently. And this bill and this new law would allow employers in certain fairly circumscribed instances to take a look at that social media for that purpose.
I'd be remiss, Chris, if I didn't bring up a major decision from the California Supreme Court that just came down in February in a mixed motive discrimination case, meaning the employer may have had both a legitimate and an illegitimate reason for taking the action that it did. What did the California Supreme Court have to say in Harris versus City of Santa Monica?
Well, this was a case where the facts are rather mixed, and the result by most commentators, including our law firm, says it's a mixed bag. As I read it, I think it's actually slightly advantageous for the employer. The plaintiff in that case was a bus driver for the City of Santa Monica. The city had a process of first training applicants and then giving them a probationary period. And during her training period, she had an accident, and then during her probationary period, she had an accident. And she also had a couple of absences during that period of time. Then she volunteered to her boss that she was pregnant. And the same day she volunteered to her boss that she was pregnant, her boss was looking over a list of employees who weren't making it through probation, and the plaintiff was one of those people, and so she was terminated. So this was a close question and an interesting one. The California Supreme Court basically had to decide what the standard would be to determine discrimination. Their choices are what is called but-for causation, that is, that the person was terminated because of a protected characteristic, or whether the protected characteristic was a motivating factor, or the third option was whether it was a substantial motivating factor. Now, even to me, a lawyer in employment law, this sounds like real inside baseball, and I think it is. It is cutting it very, very fine, and I will say for a from a practical point of view for your listeners, in my experience and in our firm's experience, most of the time a jury is thinking about what it's going to do in an employment case. It bases its decision on not this kind of legal standard, although it has to listen to and is supposed to follow it. They decide the case on what they think is fair, which is a much broader, much more amorphous standard. But getting back to the actual decision, the California Supreme Court took the middle ground and held that the Employers Act violates the law if the protected characteristic was a substantial motivating factor. What's helpful to employers is that in making this decision, although the Supreme Court didn't exactly spell out what evidence the plaintiffs have to prove to meet this burden, it did highlight that things like stray remarks in the workplace, statements by non-decision makers, and statements by decision makers unrelated to the decision-making process could not, by themselves, established that an improper bias was in fact a substantial motivating factor. So this is part of what sometimes I think of as a gentle snowfall that falls on jurors at the beginning and end of the trial, the jury instructions, and they get to sort that out. So it's a very fine point, and on balance, it's helpful to, I think, employers, because if the employer can show that it wasn't a substantial motivating factor, then the best the employee can get is injunctive relief and attorney's fees. In other words, if the employer can meet that standard, then they are not going to be liable for back pay, emotional distress, or other monetary damages. In a sense, the fly in the ointment is, even if they meet that standard, if they can show that they protected category was a substantial motivating factor, then the plaintiff can get attorney's fees, which is somewhat ironic, of course, because the plaintiff himself or herself might not get any monetary damages, but the attorney would. And that can create a problem, because that means they may go to trial, and the real driving force behind going to trial is the attorney's fees.
Now, our listeners outside of California might be interested to know that the U.S. Supreme Court will soon be hearing a mixed motive discrimination case in Nassar versus Texas Southwestern, a retaliation dispute, that one. Any similarities that you see, Chris, between that case and the one in California?
Well, certainly the aspect that it's a mixed motive case and the complexity of that legal concept will be in play before the 9 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court later this spring. However, they will, of course, be dealing with a different statute in California. It was the Fair Employment and Housing Act. There it will be what's called Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And in particular, the U.S. Supreme Court case will deal with the application of the mixed motive theory of recovery on retaliation claims, which was not an issue in California. Certainly, the U.S. Supreme Court may use the California Supreme Court's reasoning and opinion in its determination, but there are enough differences that the U.S. Supreme Court could decide it strictly on federal grounds.
Chris, there's also been a recent case about disability discrimination due to pregnancy emanating out of California, and you told me off the air that there's a point in that one that might be lost on people. Tell us about that.
Well, it was even lost on me, David, when I first read it, because what that particular case involved was a woman who had become pregnant and was given a medically required leave of absence in California. And before she gave birth, she received the maximum amount of leave allowed by the California Pregnancy Discrimination Act and a somewhat similar act. But of course, there is a third act, and it's the one I've already mentioned, the Fair Employment and Housing Act, which is the overarching major California law concerning employment discrimination. The point of this case was that the employer said, okay, to the employee, you've had your 16 weeks and that's all you get under the statute. We've given you as much as you are entitled to. We're not going to give you any more. And at 16 weeks, you're finished. You're done. You're terminated. What the court said was not fast. as your listeners who do anything with employment discrimination in the disability area know, the obligation of reasonable accommodation is not an easy concept to administer, and employers who guess wrong do so at their peril. So what the court said here was, even though the employee had received the maximum amount of leave required by the two other laws, the employer was still obligated under the Fair Employment and Housing Act to see if there might be a further reasonable accommodation, which the court said could be, believe it or not, additional leave without pay. So the takeaway from this to your listeners, as far as I'm concerned, is triple check if you're ever thinking of terminating a person who is pregnant and who you think has used all of her leave.
We just have a couple of minutes left, Chris, but I definitely wanted to ask you whether there's any advice for HR and employers in terms of compliance best practices relating to these recent developments in California.
I think the best thing you can do, and the thing that makes me feel good as an attorney counseling management, is that HR people, you know, stay abreast of the laws and the requirements. You can do that in a variety of ways. Of course, there's a lot of free information out there on the internet. For example, our firm puts out newsletters, which, as a matter of fact, I've put out there on legislative developments. And that those newsletters have a list of suggestions to HR people as to what you do. But the major things here, just from what we've talked about here today, David, is making sure that you've got a written agreement for your commission-compensated employees, that your classifications are correct. This is another area which in California is resulting in a lot of class actions. That is, employees who are classified as exempt from overtime laws because they're executives, professionals, or administrators, those classifications are very, very strictly construed against the employer. And while it may seem very tempting to say, great, you're an exempt employee, and we all know what that means. That means you can work all the hours you want for the same low price. An employer would be very well served to monitor at least once a year those positions which they've classified as exempt and make sure that the actual duties of the occupants of those positions still meet the requirements. And then, of course, be aware when employees or even now representatives can ask for copies of personnel files or portions of personnel files or in payroll records. Make sure you comply with the time limits there and give them only what they are required to under the law.
Well, Chris, I can't thank you enough for your insights. I'll let that be the last word. Chris Kobe of Littler Mendelsohn's San Jose office has been our guest. Chris, thanks so much for joining me.
It was my pleasure, David. Thank you.
I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this ExpertHR.com podcast. Thanks again for listening. Continue checking our website regularly for more podcasts on key employment topics affecting the world of HR, including an interview with EEOC General Counsel David Lopez. The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR and our subscription offering, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. And if you mention listening to this podcast, we'll give you 20% off a new subscription. That's all for now. Copyright 2013, all rights reserved.